Place WW with a question, please.
Howie recognized, when it comes to the capacitor fading in time, that's an extremely rare malady. Not impossible, but very unlikely. And if you put your vacuum tube voltmeter or your volt-ohm milliammeter or your digital voltmeter in the AC scale, where it's got a built-in isolating capacitor, there's various ways you can do that. But if your AC meter has got an isolating capacitor and you're measuring AC voltage across the capacitor, and now during the time that the power supply is going into phase, if the capacitor was going down in microfarads and you're still drawing the same amount of current, the failing capacitor would show as a larger ripple, a larger amount of AC volts. Very rare failure. I doubt it highly. But if the capacitor is cheap enough, and once you're in there, when you're replacing things, it wouldn't hurt to replace it. What some people do in a case like that, if it's not a leakage phenomenon, if it's only a capacitance phenomenon, you're allowed to put another capacitor temporarily with clip leads or solder or whatever in parallel with the one that's there. If the one that's there is 2,500 and you put another 2,500 in parallel, you'll have 5,000, which is not bad. And so that's a way of doing a test. Let's see what Howie's going to say. You got it, Howie.
Two questions. I'd like to know what pass transistor he's using, okay? Number two, I'd like to know if this fade only comes when he's loading the circuit down, when the power supply is on the load, because you're telling me for heat sinking, so it's a thermal runaway issue. That's what I want to know first, Dick. Does he see this voltage fade when he doesn't load the power supply down?
Yeah, good question. Back to you, Steve. Under what conditions is it fading? And what voltage does it fade from and to? And how much current are you drawing when you do that? Over to you, Steve.
Yeah, it's definitely a problem that only occurs under load. And it's at about an amp and a half of load. And it's dropping from the nominal 12 volts down to, just 5 or 6 volts. And so I was using this radio as the load, and so the radio just shuts off when it gets that load. So I haven't done more testing with just resistive loads or anything to find out exactly. As I said, I was suspecting the heat sinking. I don't know the exact designation of the pass, the Motorola transistor, but I don't have the unit with me, so I don't know exactly which one it is. But it's TO3K.
Okay, one quick question. Does this fade happen immediately when you put the load on? Does this happen almost immediately?
No, not immediately, but within maybe 30 seconds of being loaded at an amp and a half.
And how do you know the current is amp and a half? Is there a method by which you can monitor the current, Steve? Go ahead.
Yes, I put, there's a 0.33 ohm resistor on the output of the power supply, and so I just put my voltmeter across that, and I was reading, so that should be 330 millivolts per amp, and I had something like 545 millivolts across that resistor.
Okay, half a volt across that resistor at 1.5 amps is about 3/4 of a watt. Is that resistor heat sunk, or is it hanging in the air? Does it get hot to the touch? Over to you, Steve.
No, it's in the air. It's a large power resistor, kind of a muck. And no, it does not get warm.
Dick, he has thermal runaway. You see, what I thought the transistor might have been, damaged because it would immediately go down. But if it takes 30 seconds, it looks like it's not a capacitor. It looks like that transistor goes in the... It's a thermal runaway because it's not heat sinked.
I see, Regis. Yeah. That's about the same analysis that I have, Steve, as you can tell. A transistor, a TO3 transistor, is required to have a certain amount of gain to it. And for all we know, that's a whole three-terminal regulator. And many of these three-terminal regulators have a built-in self-protect circuit, where they start cutting themselves back in power output have the right amount of thermal conductivity to its heat sink. So right now our best guess is that your voltage regulating TO3 transistor is running into thermal runaway. It's going into a thermal protect mode because of improper heat sink. So one way or another, with pieces of mica and or the make sure you do use the heat sink compound, very thin layer of it, and the transistor tighten down very nicely to that heat sink to squeeze out as much of the heat sink compound as possible, you'll get a hell of a lot better thermal protection for that output device. It's kind of amazing that that little washer of mica conducts heat so well compared to a piece of tape. I'll bet you the difference is 50 to 1, if you know what I mean, as to its ability to conduct the heat. Out of curiosity, what kind of tape did you use? It doesn't matter, John. All tapes are bad in this case. But what kind of tape did you use? Back to you, John. I mean, Steve.
The tape you want.
I'm now also recognized. Go ahead, Steve. What kind of tape did you use?
I just used regular Scotch 33 electrical tape. And as I was doing it, I had a pretty strong suspicion that I wouldn't have sufficient heat sinking, but I thought maybe just a 2-amp power supply, and since I was only planning on pulling an amp and a half out of it, that maybe I wouldn't have problems, but obviously I do, so I'm going to have to order that 14-cent mica, or harvest some used equipment, or find a repair shop. I couldn't find any, I don't know of that many electronic shops around that still stock those little parts. What was the one that on Long Island that was mentioned?
Now, there's a couple of them. By the way, the Scotch 33, is that the black electrical tape? Go ahead.
That's correct.
Yeah, that stuff is a very good thermal insulator. Mel, go right ahead.
Okay, put your finger on it. You think it's getting hot. You put your finger on it, see if it's getting hot, the device. And you'll know right away that it's hot to the touch. What you can do temporarily, take a pair of, a small pair of, if you have a mini set of vice grips or a small pair of pliers and put a rubber band around it just so it clips to the body. That'll act as a heat sink for a test, Dick, over.
HWW with another important question.
Yeah, hold on, Howie. Howie, your audio is extremely loud. You want to cut back on that mic a little bit? We can hear you breathing. a set of vice grips on a TO3 case. I'm worried on that one, Mel, that you'll get enough thermal conductivity. The jaws of the vice grip are making very little area contact to the case. It's going to do better than nothing, but it's not going to be enough of a heat sink. I'm a little bit worried. Give us a little bit less audio and go ahead with your comment, Howie.
Yeah. Want to know if there are any Zeta dials that will give you an idea if this is a three-terminal regulator. It sounds like it's a pass transistor because he has an emitter resistor. Can you tell us if there are any Zener diodes in there? It looks like it's a single transistor where they got a Zener to ground from the base.
Okay. What else is in that circuit, Steve, that you can describe to us? Go ahead, Steve.
Very good, Howie.
Yeah, it's definitely a pass transistor. I didn't identify any Zener diodes. There's a... an IC of some sort, I don't know if it's strictly a ring, I think it's a, I looked at under the magnifying glass and it looked like a Motorola, perhaps 7539, but I did a Google search and couldn't really find anything on it. So it's either a regulator or possibly an op amp or something. That on the other side there's a stack of four diodes, also I think go to ground off of one of the terminals of this little IC. But the transistor is definitely a pass transistor with the emitter resistor and the base connected to this IC and the collector coming off the filter capacitor.
723 regular, it's a 723.
Yeah, audio is very loud, Howie. Yeah, the 723 is a very respected voltage regulator. It also has a thermal protection built in. So, step by step, you're going to get there, Steve. You're learning a lot about power supplies in the process also. Okay, anyone else with any further comments on the HW202 power supply? 12 volts or 13.8 probably at 2 amperes of output that feeds the radio. Anyone else have any further comments before we go to the next person? K2RIW listening.
Okay.
nice long blank in there. I've been getting reports of people out of the area who try to sign in. Unless we create a long blank, they don't get an opportunity to do it because of the way the VOIP system works. I think we've gone through all the list of people who had questions. Joe quite often has a question, comment, or he can bring us up to date on what's going on with his electromagnetic interference searching. So I'm going to turn it over to Joe. If you're there, Joe, go right ahead to WHYY, KQRIW.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. I did check in earlier, but the knucklehead, has to do his thing there. My question had to do with measuring field sensitivity. I'll tell you what I found out with the particular item I'm using for a detector. It seems to be about 125 microvolt sensitivity that the TV itself, the portable TV, actually can receive as far as field sensitivity by using a generator. I used a generator set up with a carrier on a particular TV frequency, and I used an AM modulation of about 31,000 hertz to give me a simulated horizontal sync signal, actually twice the sync signal. I ended up getting white, black, white display on the screen to give me something to go by instead of just a carrier. So that's how I set that up. I don't know, you can tell me if that's right or wrong. Well, in measuring this, I also found out by using a UHF HT that with the same rubber duck I used to generate the UHF TV signal and holding the UHF HT right next to that rubber duck, actually 90 degrees to it, it seemed to give me an indication of about 107 minus 107 dBm or 1 microvolt for about 20 dB of quieting. Now that radio I was able to directly couple the generator to and put it right into the radio itself. The radio itself directly coupled to the generator actually indicates about minus 115 or 0.29 microvolts for about 12 dB of quieting. Why do you suppose there's a little bit of a difference there, Dick? Back to you.
I just did a quick calculation. Assuming your television set has a 70 ohm input connector, F connector, and you're saying you get good reception on the television set at 125 microvolts, 125 microvolts is approximately minus 30 dBm. Wow. That's potent. Whereas I think a good television receiver will work rather well at minus 70 dBm. 40 dB stronger, weaker. So it would appear as though your television set is 40 dB less sensitive than I'd like it to be, although there's another catch going on here, and that is you do need 35 dB of carrier-to-noise ratio to get a completely snow-free picture. And I presume what you're judging is you're putting in a carrier from a known signal generator with known modulation on it and trying to make all the snow on the screen disappear. Something doesn't seem right. Your microvolts with your other receiver, they sound reasonable. But that television receiver with the one you want to use as a field strength indicator, I wonder how you are coupling into it. If it had a real F connector, and even though you had a 50-ohm cable and you're going into a 70-ohm connector, don't worry. That's a 1.5 standing wave ratio. The receiver wouldn't see any difference until you hit a 5-to-1, 10-to-1 standing wave ratio. It would behave approximately the same. So that's not explaining it. Or maybe it had a twin-lead pair of screws that it intended to take a twin-lead input to the television if it's a real old one, and you had some kind of a converting device that went from twin lead to a type F. And I wonder if something funny was going on with it. You could temporarily just take center conductor and shield of a piece of 50-ohm or 70-ohm coax cable and connect directly to those screws in order to make a sensitivity measurement. So before I go too much further, did I hear you correctly? 125 microvolts required for the television receiver. That, to me, is an awful potent signal. Back to you, Joe. W2RYY.
H-U-L-I-W. 125 microvolts is about minus 65 dBm at 50 ohms. There's no way to connect this television except by, clip leading to the monopole antenna on the television itself. It has no jack for measurement purposes. Why I'm asking you this question, because I'm getting a difference with the HT with two different levels, but could I assume that there's a coupling differential between having the generator directly coupled to the device and through air coupling. So that is the reading I got, about 125 microvolts to basically get rid of most of the snow on the screen of the image I was seeing. So that is correct. That's a minus 65 dBm. That's the scale settling HP 8640 I have.
I just double-checked. You're absolutely right. I made a math error. I only made an error by 35.5 dB. Oh, well. I must have taken the square root when I thought I didn't or whatever. All right, so that's more reasonable. That is a reasonable sensitivity of television set. And I presume that gave you snow-free. So I think your next question is going to be, how do I use gravity as rubber duck or whatever on the television set, make a judgment about its AGC voltage or the amount of snow on the screen in order to figure out approximately what is the range of microvolts per meter? I think that's going to be your next question, but let me pass it back to you for the next step of this process. Back to you, Joe.
No, that's not going to be the next question. The next question I'm going to have is the first one I asked, why is there a differential between using a rubber duck on a signal generator that's air-coupled as close as possible, actually having two antennas touched between that and an HT, narrowband FM HT, and directly coupling to the HT itself. I'll give you those readings again. The air coupling, it gave me a reading of about minus 107, which is one microvolt, and direct connecting to that particular UHF HT gave me a different reading of about minus 115 or 0.29 microvolts for about 20 dB equining. So there's a differential of a good couple of dBs. Can you give me an explanation of what is happening here? Because, and can I also apply that same thing to the television as far as its real sensitivity if something is directly coupled to it?
I've been down this road also. Where I ran into it is that RFID tags contain a dipole antenna, and I tried to find out what was the sensitivity of an RFID device by taking another dipole fed with a signal generator and come right up to the dipole of the RFID chip, of the RFID tag, and assuming that because they're essentially touching each other with a thousandth of an inch separation between the two, that the signal would couple directly. Good guess, doesn't work that way. When a dipole is receiving a signal, it has to be in free air, able to resonate in its normal manner. You bring another object alongside of that dipole, which kills its resonance on that frequency, and all of a sudden its sensitivity is something entirely different. Good common sense would lead you to believe that another dipole of even the exact same physical length and the exact same center frequency, essentially in contact, common sense would lead you to believe the signal should couple from dipole A transmission line to the output of transmission line on dipole B, and the two of them are slapped right up against each other. Common sense would lead you to believe I should get 0.2 dB of insertion loss. You do that experiment, and you start off with around 5 decibels of loss. You went from 107 to 115. You had 8 dB of loss. I have seen 5 or 6 dB of loss. And if you're willing to retune the dipole just right, you can get it down to about 3. But dipoles do not directly couple the way you think they would. Because as you bring objects into the near field of the dipole, you kill its normal resonance phenomena by which it picks up that signal. So it defies common sense. When you look at the right reference books, like the Antenna Engineering Handbook, I think it's around Chapter 2, where they talk about the coupling coefficient between collinear and broadside dipoles. And as the position between the two gets very small, the impedance perturbation becomes so huge that the amplitude of coupling signal really becomes kind of weird. It's something I haven't completely experienced, I completely explained, but I've experienced exactly what you've experienced. So it doesn't show anything wrong with your repeater.
Time out.
It doesn't show anything wrong with your rubber duck or your dipole, no matter what the antenna is. You can't bring something that close and get normal performance out of the antenna. So when it comes to measuring the sensitivity of that particular system, you're going to have to couple directly into its antenna port. The antenna itself, you're going to have to, by other means, estimate its gain when it's in free space. And when it's not in free space because something else is nearby, it behaves in a very different way that's not desirable. Over to you, Joe, K2RIW.
Okay, well, this is going to be a tough one then, so it's going to be kind of tough because this antenna is about maybe 12, maybe 14 inches long, maybe 16 inches long, I'd say, when fully extended. And it's designed to couple, you know, signals in from VHF and UHF and receive television. So it's going to be kind of tough to try to estimate and get this thing to actually give you a real-time kind of indication of how many microvolts per meter or field, the effective field sensitivity of this television actually absolutely is. That's what it's really ultimately trying to do, which actually comes back to another question. Microvolts per meter is pretty much a standard reference of measurement of different types of RF emitting devices or looking at signal levels from a device at a certain distance away. Now, if I understand correctly, microvolts per meter, you're using an antenna that is 1 meter in length to receive something on, okay? How does that work out if the antenna is not resonant? Because a 1 meter antenna can't possibly be resonant every frequency you try to use this thing on. Do you have to actually have the antenna used with a tuned circuit or something similar to that to resonate the antenna per frequency to get an accurate measurement of such?
Good question. And now you're into the sticky area. I'll warn you, this is not going to make sense at first. Common sense would lead you to believe you'd use an antenna or a sensing device of some kind that has a 1 meter length to the sensing device in order to directly measure microvolts per meter. Good common sense. Does not work that way. Life ain't that simple. You're about to ask, how does it really work? I'm going to give you a step-by-step process. The first time you hear it, you're going to say, what in the world is going on? You're going to have to hear it two or three times. If I had an antenna that had 1 square meter of effective capture area to it. Man, that's not the right way of putting it. I'm thinking of a better, a good way of putting this that'll all make sense. If I had a known number of microvolts per meter, I'm going to do the problem in the inverse manner. Assume I know the number of microvolts per meter of the antenna, of the signal. The field strength, the signal radiated into free space, someone told you it's got X number of microvolts per meter. And you want to know what is the antenna conversion factor for your particular antenna. You have to first, by some means, measure the gain of your antenna. If you know the gain of the antenna, and you know the frequency at which your antenna is operating, you can convert that into an effective capture area that that antenna has. The formula for that is area equals gain lambda squared over 4 pi. The area in square meters equals gain as a hard number, not decibels. You have to take the anti-decibels of the real gain, and it's over isotropic. Gain over isotropic is a hard number, times wavelength squared that your antenna works at, divided by 4 pi. I'll plug in some numbers just to show you how it works. Assume that my antenna has 10 dB of gain over isotropic. Nice thing about 10 dB of gain, when you divide by 10,
repeater, timeout.
To convert from a log number to an anti-log number, you first divide by 10, then take anti-log, then take a raise it to the power of 10. The nice thing about 10 dB of gain is it turns out to be a real number of 10. So the gain number turns out to be 10 in my example. If my wavelength happened to be 1 meter, because I'm operating at 300 megacycles, 1 meter, 1 squared is still 1, divided by 4 pi, I would 10 divided by 4 pi. 4 pi is approximately 12. I'd have a number a little bit less than unity. In other words, that antenna, 10 dB of gain, 300 megacycles, I go through the numbers, 10 divided by 12.4, I'm going to round it off and say it's 0.9. 0.9 square meter is the effective capture area of that antenna. I'm just using my example. Now you're about to ask, what happens with 10 microvolts per meter if someone tells me that is the field strength? You know that the field strength was measured in a medium where free space has an impedance of 377 ohms. you assume that that number of microvolts per meter is being applied to a resistor of 377 ohms, E squared over R, you know how to calculate power. That E squared over R would give you the right answer if the antenna had 1 square meter of effective area. Yours has 9/10, and therefore it's going to have approximately a half a dB of difference, and whether it's plus or minus, we'll worry about that later. I'm giving you the step-by-step process by which you can see a little bit about how you go from field strength and microvolts per meter into how many microvolts is going to come out of my antenna and go into my receiver. You've got to know the gain of the antenna, the frequency you're operating at. You can see that as you go to higher and higher frequencies, your antenna is going to be smaller and smaller, your resonant antenna. Its effective capture area is going to be less. Therefore, it's going to get less and less signal in microvolts going into your receiving device, even though your antenna has got the exact same gain. It's going to sound like craziness. I can have a 10 dB gain antenna at 300 megs.
Repeater, timeout.
And I decide to make the measurement at 3 gigs instead, 10 times higher in frequency. 10 times higher in frequency, the antenna itself physically is going to be 1/10 the length, because it's the effective area of the antenna we're talking about, and that's a function of lambda squared. I'm going to have 1/100 the area. A 10 dB gain antenna at 3 gigs has 100 times less effective area than a 10 dB gain antenna at 300 megs. Therefore, the signal level I'm going to be picking up with the 3 gig antenna is going to be 20 decibels weaker, even though the field strength I'm measuring is the exact same number of microvolts per meter. You can see some of the craziness going on here. I haven't given you the whole answer. Anybody can give you a great big long formula with 40 terms to it, and you plug in all the terms, and you hope you haven't put in the wrong value where it asks for millivolts and you put in microvolts, or it asks for dBm and you put in dB and so on. It's very easy to take a great big formula doing this jazz and get an answer that it looks okay if you don't have enough experience to know it's crazy. So you got to be able to do a back-of-the-envelope rough approximation of what I just indicated to you in order to know whether or not your answer is at least in the ballpark. I know all of that is not going to make sense the first time you hear it, but maybe some of it did. Let me pass it back to you, Joe. To me, 2RYY, K2RIW.
It seems like what you're saying is that it's going to be very difficult to take this TV receiver and use it for anything realistic as far as a measuring device.
I didn't say that at all. I just said that the Joe that I know is going to have to go through a significant learning curve in order to find out how, with the instrumentation you already own, you've got enough instrumentation, but you've got a significant learning curve in order to convert the hardware that you own into making rough ballpark figures of microvolts per meter. And at first you'd say, gee, I'm going to get 3 dB, 5 dB of error. If you have 6 dB of error in your instrumentation setup with what you're trying to do, believe it or not, that would only be a 2-to-1 difference in apparent microvolts per meter. You double the microvolts per meter, and the signal strength changes by 6.02 dB. So you're going in the direction where an awful lot of error doesn't make a huge difference in the microvolts. You're trying to estimate how many microvolts per meter is being radiated by that system that's giving you the interference. And so you can have some reasonably big errors by normal lab measurement technology and still come up with an answer that's in the right ballpark. You know how to plug in a signal directly by taking the center conductor and shield, so to speak, plug it directly into the F connector of the radio of the television center. That's what's going to be used. And if you had access to the AGC voltage in there and you got a meter connected to it, great. If you're making a judgment by the amount of snow on the screen, it's going to be a little bit fuzzier measurement, but still you can do it. You can measure how many microvolts of signal on a television frequency gives you a similar AGC voltage or response on the television screen. Now, the monopole antenna, which I think you said extends to something like 18 inches coming out of it, we can make a rough guess as to what the gain of that monopole is. it's going to be very close to dipole-like gain. Subtract a couple of dB because it doesn't have a really great ground plane. But that's close enough. Right now, I mean, if this was a court of law, the judge would say, hey, there's a huge difference between rape and murder. But by the same token here, whether or not you're getting millivolts per meter or microvolts per meter, you're going to know that right away. Will you be able to resolve the difference between 20 microvolts and 25 microvolts per meter? I'm not so sure. But still, the rough level, you've got the right instrumentation. You can make the measurement.
Repeater, timeout.
If you find out on that whip antenna of the television set, the portable television set, how close you have to stand to the source in order to get a known response, and then you come back to your signal generator and plug it in directly to the television set and get the same response, I'm pretty sure me and maybe one or two other people on this net will eventually convert that for you into microvolts per meter. And we'll show you the step-by-step process to do it. Back to you, Joe, K2LIW.
Okay, well, the problem's basically been solved as far as the cross-the-street problem because the cable company guy did come in the other day. And he did fix the problem, and he replaced the drop, which really wasn't significant in the problem. What basically was, the drop comes in on the outside of the house, and the drop goes to a three-port splitter on the outside of the house, and one of the lines was going upstairs behind the bushes, and when the landscaper trimmed the bushes, he trimmed the cable line also in a couple of places. He skinned it, you know, noticeably. Now, after this guy tried repairing this line by cutting a length out and splicing another piece of cable in, his indicator of leakage did not really indicate leakage. I was picking up stuff on my television set on a, with a video, a good picture quality signal I could view, and his leakage detector was not going off. And it ended up there must have been some sort of leakage or something coming from the TV set or device plugged in upstairs where this cable was actually feeding. That's the signal I was actually seeing because when he disconnected this upstairs line, the leakage indication completely went away. Wasn't able to see any picture whatsoever. So I was able to see something, and his leakage detector wasn't able to indicate it.
Whoa. Hey, you just gave us a very significant part of the story. It reminds me of that joke where somebody is minding your house while the guy's away in Florida. And the guy called up on the telephone. How's it going? Oh, everything's all right. Well, are you sure? Well, your cat died. My cat died? How'd that happen? Well, the cat died when the garage burned down. The garage burned down? How'd that happen? Well, the garage got caught on fire because of the house. And you can see the way it goes. Obviously, there's a lot more to the story that we haven't heard. You apparently called the cable company. You were one of the very few guys that got good response from the cable company. While the guy is over there from the cable company fixing this piece of cable that had been chopped up by the landscaper, apparently you were over there, or at least across the street, making measurements on your television set. I have the impression that you got a chance to talk to the cable guy and say, hey, the problem is still there, even though it's not showing. And hopefully he went further. He disconnected that cable to the second floor. The problem went away. And there's even a slim chance that he had enough gumption to go in the house and go the next step and find out what was on the second floor creating the problem. Like maybe the person had backed the television set away from the wall, yanked the cable while doing vacuuming, and ripped up that particular piece of cable. So give us a little more of the story. There's a lot more success here than we knew about, Joe. You apparently got a good response out of the cable company, or at least you got a lot of response. Maybe you didn't get a complete cure yet. W2LYY, K2LIW, tell us more.
Okay, well, I didn't want to bore you with details. I didn't know that you don't want to know the details or something like this. I thought you just wanted to hear the end result. I first called up the cable services customer service department, and they basically told me have the customer directly call them because they couldn't do anything without him calling it. I says, okay, fine. I thought to myself, if that's the way you want to play the game out. The other way was... I have another way of doing things. And I called up the corporate office in Bethpage, and I said, look, I explained the whole problem. And I said, look, this is a problem that I think you really ought to address. And they did. They had somebody from the field operations call me directly. And he said, yes, we're going to have somebody out there. He had to have the guy out there in the middle of pouring rain the other day. But need that, be that as it may, the guy basically did fix the problem. And I could see the signal from across the street weak, but I walked up with my Sony Watchman. I said Walkman last week. It's actually Sony Watchman. And I showed the guy the picture, and I stood next to the corner of the house, and I said, see, I can see stuff that your indicator it cannot see. He originally had an indication on his device, which is, I think, looking at something, I was told those things, like a trilithic, I think, is the manufacturer of the RF snippet that they use, and it's tuned to something like 139 megahertz. They have, I guess, a good interest in making sure there's no leaks down there because near the aircraft fan. But his indicator was not leaking, indicating a leakage down there, and I said to the guy that sometimes you can have leaks on some frequencies and not at other frequencies, and not have it in the area where you're looking, and it could be worse elsewhere. And since this is the only device he has, if it passes on his device with his numbers, he's happy. But I was showing him up on the UHF TV band that I was getting, you know, a quite watchable picture standing, I guess, maybe 15 feet away from the linear feet away from the actual leakage itself, and I was getting a quite snow-free view of the picture. So, it basically ended up, it had a happy ending to it. He ended up disconnecting the cable and not connecting it. He went inside the house, he talked to the homeowner, but he never did solve the problem, so he left the cable on the outside of the house disconnected, because apparently he did not want to, or couldn't solve the problem inside the house. So that's how the problem basically ended. I still have more leakage in the neighborhood, but that's the story for another day.
Fantastic, Joe. Okay, so not only did the corporate office respond, even though the local office did not, in other words, you went to the next level, and you got them to really move, and you just happened to be there when he was there, or he called you back and said, I'm going to be there on Tuesday at 3 in the afternoon, come and meet me. Fantastic. Do you believe that the homeowner was no longer using the cable on the second floor? He was happy to have that cable disconnected? Back to you, Joe.
I haven't talked to him directly about that, to actually ask him how his cable service has been, if it's been changed, improved, or whatever. I didn't really ask him. I don't know the details about that. I don't know if it was actually connected to a TV set, or what it was actually connected to upstairs, but apparently the cable guy did not solve the problem because he left the connection off on the splitter outside and terminated the splitter. So this house only has two lines going to it internally instead of three lines.
And since the customer hopefully was home during these measurements, because he went in the house, wasn't able to solve it, and the customer is not complaining, it sounds like whatever used to go to the second floor is no longer being used. For all we know, that was a piece of cable coming out of the wall that used to go to a TV set that got trampled on or frayed because the homeowner pulled the set away from the wall while doing vacuuming, and they discontinued using that particular set and just left the cable there. Who knows? Or something's wrong with the wiring in the wall itself. So it sounds like you've got a significant improvement there. Sounds to me like you did very little interfacing with the homeowner, which means you're not, as far as the homeowner is concerned, being blamed for the slight amount of intervention of the cable company. The cable company is just making sure that their hardware was wired correctly and not violating any FAA rules. Was the homeowner observing you with the Walkman showing a good signal to the cable guy? Kind of curious about that. And what other signals are leaking in your neighborhood? Is it from a cable system? Back to you, Joe.
The guy who owns the house, his wife is in. I wasn't going to bother her because I didn't initially talk to her. I talked to him. He wasn't home. He was at work or whatever. So, but he was aware of what I showed him, what I showed the cable guy, because I said, look, I could see TV pictures when I did. I said, look, if you don't mind, I'd like to walk through a walk around the house. I walked around the perimeter of his house, and I can only see the leakage on the TV set at one corner of his house. And it happened to be right at the same corner the drop was coming into the house. I says, okay, either the drop has a crack in the outside of the shield, where you got something inside the house that's leaking energy out that's upstairs. Because the corner of his house where I was getting it from is actually the corner of the garage. I can't imagine a guy would have a TV inside his garage. So there was some sort of bedroom or something directly above the house. It's a split ranch, so there has to be something upstairs that's radiating signal. There is other leaks in the neighborhood on the same frequency, but it's much less in intensity. It's coming from a house like two houses away from him. And I told the cable guy about that. He did a walk up the block with me with a little cable sniffer, and he could not see this indication on his device, which I think is really sensitive at one frequency. Now look at a bunch of frequencies, which makes me wonder how they really ensure that that they're passing this CLI type of numbers that they have to pass as far as what they're required, the cumulative leakage indicator number. If he's only looking at one frequency, he's got leaks at other frequencies, how do you find out something? And I should, you know, I guess if I was a little impressed with I had a TV, a portable TV, that will walk around, tune to these frequencies and look at cable stuff over the air.
Fantastic. I'd love to know how he calibrated that thing. I'm led to believe that if it never saw anything, and that's the instrumentation that he uses to think he's got a good system, and you can pick up a snow-free picture into a Walkman, boy, there's a lot of decibels of error there somewhere. Did his field strength indicator ever go off the bottom peg? And as you showed him the Walkman getting a snow-free picture on some other frequency, and yes, you're absolutely right, he's got to meet that cumulative leakage index essentially on all frequencies. On the FA frequencies, of course, are the most important. But for him to only ensure that it works at that frequency is a necessary but not sufficient, as I see it, craziness. So did his field strength indicator ever come off the peg? And what was his words of explanation? I guess you already told me. He's only required to make sure 139 megacycles is not leaking. He doesn't care about any other frequency. That's much too narrow a band of view. You and I know that for sure, Joe. There's more to the story. W2RYY, K2RYW.
Well, I happen to know that the leakage indicator works at that frequency because I asked one of the other managers I happened to talk to about a year and a half ago, which about a similar type of problem, which is a similar type of leakage problem, which is another whole other story in itself. I do know it works at that frequency. I think I looked up the specs on it once. I probably have to go back on Google and put the model information I have written down somewhere on that particular device, but it's only tuned to one frequency, and I guess they use it near the aircraft frequency because that's the most critical thing that they're really, really worrying about. You know, that really gets them, you know, upset if they're radiating stuff in the middle of the aircraft, man, from like, you know, 108 to 137. They probably pay a lot of attention to stuff down there. Other stuff in other parts of the band maybe doesn't excite them too terribly much. But this particular tech, I didn't ask him specific questions. I was able to look over his shoulder and he walked up the street with me, and his indicator was indicating a number 5 to 6. It's an LCD indicator on the display. He just turns it on. It looks about the size of a cell phone. It's about the similar to like a flip cell phone closed type of thing. That's what it looks like. But there's no, I don't know specifically what that number 5 or 6 actually represented on the scale. I don't know that much about them. I have to look them up online and actually see what the display indication actually indicates the thing. I have another type of problem which relates to this. Maybe you can shed some light on this because this is also, I think it's also related to cable. A cable system, and it's been driving me nuts for a couple of years. It hasn't been something that's just happened. In the neighborhood, there's a line amplifier up the block from me, and that powers the block that's north, goes north and south, that's west of me, and then, of course, my block by itself. That's the way the signal feeds the whole neighborhood. I can stand near the pole at the west corner of my street, where it joins the other street, and get a maximum indication of a pulsing signal that pulses about 4 times per second. And the pulsing will range in a bandwidth of frequencies from, say, about 430 megahertz up to about 460 or 470. But it seems to be centered more around 430 to 440. The line amplifier is not on that pole right there. The line amplifier is actually about 3 poles south of it in that location. And the indication goes away. I DF this array with a UHF beam, and it always comes back to that pole. And I cannot find out what this actual radiating type of energy, where exactly where it's come from. And I have had an FCC engineer actually come out to my house, and he claimed he measured from 10 megahertz to 500 meg, and he said he couldn't see this. Okay? And I found it, and I could see it. I can listen to it on my R7000 in the AM mode if I get close to it, and if I take my HP analyzer and run it on a portable battery pack, with the analyzer set up on, say, a bandwidth of 3 megahertz bandwidth, and looking at a span of, say, 2, 3, or 4 megs at any particular frequency around where I see this thing, I can see the pulse energy come up as high as 50 to 60 dBm indicated on each spectrum analyzer is using a quarter wave and a UHF set up in the mobile. If I drive right near this pole, I can see this. Can't tell what or where this signal is actually emanating from. It's been driving me nuts.
Yeah, let me ask you a question about what you just said. You said plus 50 or plus 60 dBm. Plus 60 dBm is 1,000 watts. Are you telling me you were getting a 1,000 watt indication on your spectrum analyzer? Obviously, you had a lot of decibels of dialed into the front end. That sounds like an awfully potent signal. Back to you, Joe.
Excuse me, I made a mistake of putting the minus sign in front of the thing, okay? Minus 50 dBm, not plus 50 dBm. I know the difference.
Okay, you did say plus. Now I understand. And you meant minus. All righty. That's a lot more reasonable. When you're at home on your own antenna, that's how you heard it the first time, with a rotatable 450 antenna of some kind, roughly how strong was the signal at home, Joe? Which is, I guess, a block and a half away.
Well, it's much less. How I actually discovered this in the beginning was a temporary repeater I had set up on the house listing on a vertical antenna with a preamp on the receiver. I would notice as I get into the distance with a weak signal, I'd hear the pulsing noise on top of my carrier getting into the repeater. It would become a little annoying. Now, at that time, I did not have an outside antenna, either like UHF or TV-wise, to be able to DF this thing from the house itself, so I really couldn't tell where it was coming from. I had to set up a small portable beam, stick it up outside the car window, and drive around the block a few times to see exactly where it was coming from. So I can hear it at my house, all right? And as I said, it's about 4 pulses per second you can hear it audibly. With the sweep time set to about maybe 42 milliseconds or so, you can almost freeze the display. You can't see each pulse because he groups the pulses that come out in like spurts. As this thing, you can hear the sticking sound goes off. Now, here's the interesting part of the whole story. As the repeater actually transmits power out, when my repeater transmits, it makes this pulsing energy almost triple in speed. So it is sensitive to the RF energy coming out of my repeater transmitter. With the antenna in my house, I think you've seen what that is. It's a 7.5 dB antenna that's up there that does that. So this device, whatever it is, has got to be, like, say, linearly at least 200 to 250 feet away from me, linearly, and it's being changed by the RF energy radiated out of my antenna. Now, I actually proved that it's not my antenna itself or repeater that's causing it, because I had a friend of mine take my car and drive right up and down the block, and when he got to the corner pole where I'm seeing this energy come from, as he transmitted with my mobile, and he's a ham, of course, I could actually look at the spectrum analyzer through that same antenna at my house through the duplex, so I wouldn't see him, and when he transmitted, he could excite it the same way. So something is being excited by the RF radiation out of my mobile when you get right on top of it. Don't, as I said, I don't know what this device is, if it's something in there where a line amplifier is being going crazy with me getting near the thing, but it's radiating signal that's, you know, getting a little annoying, and it's taking up about like 20, 30 megahertz worth of spectrum space you can hear this pulsing on. So any other ideas or thoughts on this?
I think you said it makes 4 pulses per second, so therefore it must sound like somebody is typing at about 50 words a minute. Is that approximately what it sounds like? And then I think you said the pulses per second increases when RF is present, either from your repeater or from the guy in your mobile. Back to you, Joe.
Yeah, what you hear is a pulse. It sounds like almost like a tick type of. You hear like a ticking sound that sounds very similar to the what you hear from say like a motor, a gas powered motor running with one cylinder, and they're running at low RPMs or low speed, or extremely low speed. You hear that kind of tick or that kind of sound of the energy coming out of this device. And as I said, it's about four pulses per second, and when it gets excited by an external RF field, it seems to either sound like it's doubling or almost tripling in speed.
And I think you said you reported this to the FCC. They came and made field strength measurements, and and I think you brought portable equipment up to that particular pole, close as you can get to the amplifier, you're getting a significant indication, and the field strength indicator being used by the FCC guy did not see it. Is that approximately what you said, Joe?
Yes, the difference is I wasn't there when the FCC actual engineer actually came and rode up and down the block, and he sent me an email back claiming that he couldn't see anything from 10 megahertz to 500 meg. That's what he scanned. So I wish I could have been there at the day he came out there so I could have showed him my setup, drove it down the block and say, this is what I'm seeing being radiated out on the air. But he used something different. I didn't see what he said. He just told me he used some sort of detecting device that scanned between 10 megahertz and 500 meg, and he could not see anything indicated on his device. Whether he has the same kind of tunable device the cable TV guy had, except it's tunable per frequency or not, I don't know that.
Yeah, there are certain kinds of extremely brief pulses of RF energy that when you look at them on a spectrum analyzer, take up a very large bandwidth. And if you look at it with a very narrow resolution filter, you see very little of that energy. You think there's nothing there. There could be a significant difference in the resolution bandwidth that you're using versus the resolution bandwidth that his machine used. And it does sound like it's an error in that equipment. Sounds like it's a kind of a failure. I'm having trouble believing it's supposed to do that. And a big factor is, what is the bandwidth being used for making the measurement? Very similar to what you've seen from time to time, where certain kinds of noise will show up in the AM mode on your R7000, but may not show up in the FM mode. Certain kinds of noise you can easily hear in the single sideband mode, or CW mode, which you may not hear in the other modes. So you got to have the right detecting method, the right bandwidth, the right location, the right polarization of the antenna, in order to really see the signals at times. And that amplifier that's apparently a line driver is, I guess, your guess, a cable company line driver amplifier, may even be a bidirectional amplifier, and they're a lot more vulnerable because the bidirectional amplifier has to have just the right kind of filtering so it doesn't lock up on its own signals between transmitting and receiving. And I presume the cable company might have bidirectional functions. Some of the more exotic cable companies, you can buy things through the cable company, so it allows signal to flow in both directions, and those things are more vulnerable. Back to you for any comments on all of the above, Joe. K2RIW.
Of course the signal is bidirectional on the cable amplifiers because you're using the same cable amplifier system to give you internet, which has to be bidirectional. You have an uplink channel and a downlink channel, so it's definitely bidirectional through the whole system. When I originally discovered this particular type of problem, and I could hear it on my repeater receiver, I air injected a signal, knowing what the repeater sensitivity was by itself with the preamp with the repeater. I air injected a signal and actually had to increase the generator about 30 to 35 decibels above 20 dB of quieting to make this pulsing pretty much go away. And 20 dB of quieting is out, say about 0.25 with the preamp, 0.2, 0.25. I had to go up about 35 dB of signal strength to make the pulsing completely go away. So that's how strong it was coming into my antenna. Now, yeah, when I put the analyzer on a narrow band mode, you couldn't see it. Maybe every once in a while you'd see one pulse beyond the frequency of your interest in looking at it on a narrow bandwidth, and with the span also being rather narrow, you wouldn't see it. Oh, it would just occasionally be there. And I think you measured this you said something about this yourself. You were measuring something with a type of device one time with one of these Enritsu analyzers or something like that. I think you said the same thing because they don't have a fast enough scan time to be able to catch this. Well, knowing that the HP has a CRT in the thing, that's why I increased the bandwidth and slowed down the sweep speed. And I was able to see this thing actually put it in on trace hold and watch this thing fill out about 30, 40 megahertz of band. The signal bands, say, from 430 to 470, and I see that these pulses fill out the band over maybe a few seconds, and you have the whole screen, you can watch and look at the energy displayed over, the entire 40 megahertz. So that's what I have. Don't know what the problem is, don't know where it's coming from exactly, but it's out there.
And why you see the pulses sometimes, and sometimes you don't see the pulses, is called the probability of intercept problem. a good spectrum analyzer is scanning across that frequency region that you have on the left and right hand side of the screen, some number of scans per second, maybe 10 or 20 scans per second, if it's a non-storage cathode ray tube type. If it's a storage type, if it's got a display matrix and a and you're painting signals onto the display matrix and they are being upgraded to the screen at some other rate, there are various ways that some of the modern day equipment like Inritsu, a nice solid state screen, nice compact machine, but it's not particularly good at catching certain kinds of transient information. I was on a project a year ago in which I had to catch a certain kind of transient information. I had to stop using the modern day, very portable, flat screen type spectrum analyzers and go back to an old fashioned cathode ray tube type, which was scanning very rapidly in real time. And it would easily display the intermittent structure of the signal I was looking for. And the modern day spectrum analyzer showed almost nothing. Occasionally you would see something, but you would think there's almost nothing there. And the signal I was looking for was 30 decibels above the noise, but intermittent. So you run into a very similar problem when you're trying to use a spectrum analyzer and a sweeping signal generator to try to trace out the filter shape of a bandpass filter. Because the two sweep at two different rates, it takes a long time in the storage mode to fill up the screen to eventually show you the shape of the filter. If you've got a tracking signal generator, it can do it in one sweep. Without the tracking signal generator, you may have to wait 10 or 15 minutes to fill up the screen to show your particular display. And as you use more and more narrow resolution bandwidth on the spectrum analyzer, the probability of intercept problem gets worse and worse. You're going to the narrow resolution bandwidth filter because you're looking for the fine details of passband and notch and whatever of the filter. But the narrow filter forces you to sweep the spectrum analyzer slower, and the probability of intercept problem goes up fantastically if it's not a tracking signal generator. And even if it is a tracking signal generator, you have to then worry about the accuracy of the tracking. Will the signal stay in the center of repeater?
Timeout.
As the tracking signal generator sweeps along with the spectrum analyzer, will the signal have enough frequency accuracy of the two independent sweeping devices so that the signal stays in the center of the narrowband resolution of your resolution bandwidth? So there's a whole lot of ways you can get a phony response with that kind of a setup. And it takes a lot of smarts and a lot of experience of looking at intermittent signals or sweeping signals with two independent sweeping devices, like sweeping SIGGEN and a sweeping spectrum analyzer. One way of doing it is to sweep the spectrum analyzer extremely slowly, as long as it's got a storage screen. With where you stand right now, I guess, are you still plagued with the problem of your repeater shows these four ticks per second that sometimes go three times higher? Back to you, Joe, the V2RYY, K2RYW.
Oh, sure, it's still there right now. And I could listen to the R7000 if I actually put the R7000 on 439.250, which is one of the CATV frequencies. Being that I have a beam now that I can rotate and look at it in different directions, when I point the antenna west at that particular pole, I can hear the pulsing underneath the CATV carrier that's on 439.250.
Okay. I wonder if anyone else has any further comments on all of the above. Give us your call letters right now. Paul, WS2N, I haven't heard from him tonight. Eric, KE2EJ, haven't heard from him tonight. And did I make the mistake of skipping anyone that signed in that did have a question or a comment? Or is there a brand new person? Whatever your reason, come and talk to us, K2RIW.
WV2HWW requested a long deep line stick about interference legality.
Okay. I heard, Howie, I heard another person on the input. Who was the other person?
WS2N. Yeah, Dick, I've been listening, but I didn't have anything for tonight, but I am here. Good evening.
Yeah, but the shuttle landed, I think it was last Thursday, and had to land at Edwards Air Force Base because I guess there was bad weather at the Florida location. I can hear a couple words on that, but let's see what Howie's got to say first. Go ahead, Howie.
But Dick, I'd like to know if this is illegal. I think this is illegal. A friend was showing me on the internet.